Looking forward to another hour of Esther. Someone wrote, we got tons of snow, we're also on lockdown. Yeah, that's a fair point. So maybe that means people will be able to stick around. The snow's not so bad outside, though, I have to say. So we're hopefully going to not only finish Perek Bet, chapter 2, but even start Perek Gimel. I want to start on chapter 3 as well. That's my goal. Hopefully everybody was able to download the source sheet from the email. If you had any trouble downloading it, let me know, please. But at this point, I'm including a thing in there, a graphic telling you where to click, and I'm doing everything I can to make it accessible. I want to thank once again Dana and Ilan Rubenstein for dedicating the series for the year, as well as this class is linked to the following donations from the Day of Giving we held in July. Susan Pearl. Thank you, Susan. Shalom Rosenzweig and Harry and Sarah Raz. Also, a little birdie told me that someone has a birthday today. So, the birdie isn't
Happy
smiling.
Happy birthday, Joyce.
Happy birthday, Joyce.
Mine was supposed to be anonymous. Thank you.
They emailed you. I don't know. Okay. The person who did it was supposed to email the people and ask them if it's okay. So, I'm sorry. All right, so last time we established within this chapter the theme of the Jews as a nation in exile. And we pointed out how that relates to the tension about whether Mordechai and Esther want her to become queen or do not want her to become queen. Is the idea of hiding her origins specifically in order to prevent her from being selected or to increase the odds of her being selected? Either way, it reflected an exile mentality. The only question was how exactly to understand it. Is she hiding harmful information about her lineage? Is she hiding positive information about her lineage? And then we also talked about the names, Mordechai and Esther, which are associated with Mesopotamian gods, not Persian gods, but Mesopotamian ones. And we asked what we're meant to draw from that. And I think the answer is what I had suggested last time, which is going back to the first chapter in Daniel, we saw that the Babylonians tried to replace the names of Jews, particularly those names that were associated with God, and give them instead names of Babylonian gods. And I think that that's what you're seeing here. That would be to me the easiest and most straightforward explanation. We saw it in Daniel, we see it again in Esther, and as we're going to see today, there are loads more connections between the book of Daniel and the book of Esther. So what I want to do is talk about Mordechai at the palace gate, because that's a problem, and the famous seed medrash, the medrash about Esther going vegetarian in the palace. Where does that come from? What is it building on? And then to move from that in chapter 3 to the elevation of Haman, and to try to understand who Haman was before the start of the book of Esther. Why do the Midrashim say what they do? You may be familiar with the Midrash that he was a barber. Where in the world did that come from? And can I get access to him? So we have to talk about that. All right. So we start with Mordechai at the palace gate. Mordechai spends so much of this book sitting at the gate of the palace. If you look at your sheet, I gave you GPS in source number 1. That is a collection of verses in the book of Esther, I believe exhaustive, although I didn't actually double-check that. But it's just, looking through for Shaar HaMelech references in the book. The first one is when he's at Chatzar Beit Hanashim, when he's actually hanging around outside where the women are during Esther's time before she's selected as queen. And then thereafter, we see him. Chapter 2, sentence 19, sentence 21, chapter 4, chapter 5, chapter 6. Mordechai lives at Shaar HaMelech, the gate of the king. And the question we have to ask is, why? What is this about? I'm going to ask everybody but Moish, because I know Moish's theory. He's already shared it with me. I'll incorporate it, because it's going to become relevant, Moish. But everybody else first. Why is Mordechai at the king's gate? What does it mean to sit at the king's gate?
Well, it could be a reflection on his importance.
Mm-hmm.
And it also could be a reflection on being in the place of action. You know, judges sit at the gates, etc. So you believe each other.
Like, so Rebecca is floating two ideas, right? Number one, this is a power position to be in. And number two, it's a position for activism. Okay, Janine, you were going to say?
I don't know. Is it not possible that he's just trying to keep an eye and get news about about Esther? It's the fact that he says meet Halek, that doesn't sound like he's sitting involved in some activity. It's more like he's just pacing back and forth.
So when you talk about the opening verse where he's not at the palace gate, right, then it says mithalech. You're right. He's walking around past there. However, the other references, Yoshev Bishar HaMelech in sentence 19, Yoshev Bishar HaMelech in sentence 21, clearly he's sitting when he antagonizes Haman in chapter 3. Generally speaking, he's not necessarily mithalech. That's a reference specifically to when he's trying to find out about Esther, as the text there says.
Joyce. Don't all the dignitaries sit at the gate?
So that's indeed a possibility, right? And that would support what Rebecca is saying, that this is a position of power. Let me launch into this and let's look at this. What Moish wants to add is that Mordechai is the only one, the only Jew at the palace gate. And we're going to come back to that idea. But keep in mind, and Joyce was alluding to this, that we often view the Sha'ar in Tanakh, the gate, as the place where the elders sit, and particularly for judgment and ceremonies. So, for example, if you remember in the book of Ruth, right, when Boaz wants to take care of the business of transferring the rights to marry Ruth from this fellow Ploni Amoni to himself, he wants to do this at the gate of the city. There are the Midrashim, which Rashi quotes about Lot being at the gate of the city in Sodom, and that he becomes a judge, and they tell him, you're judging us, and all of that. There is this idea that the gate is a place for elders, for leaders. And that's the view of various commentators, older and newer, on our story. And they use it to explain why Mordechai is there. It's consistent with what Rashi said earlier. You remember that when we said that they're hiding Esther's identity, they're hiding her lineage. So Rashi took the view that her lineage is positive, saying that she is descended from Shaul. Rashi thought she's from Shaul, we talked about that, would actually be more likely to land her the job as queen, and therefore they hide it because otherwise she would become queen. And here Mordechai gets to be at the palace gate because they know Mordechai is from Shaul. This is really interesting to me because we've played up the idea of Jews being in exile and not having a position of power. Nonetheless, others support this idea. Take a look at source number 2 at Ibn Ezra, where Ibn Ezra writes, V'yadanu, he says, we know, ki Mordechai haya migdolei Yisrael, Mordechai was among the leaders of Israel, ki hinehu shlishi lasarim ha'olim im Zerubbabel. Remember last week when we noted the verse in Ezra that Mordechai was alongside Zerubbabel. He was in Zerubbabel's elite group of leaders. He's third on the list. Where you are listed actually matters, apparently. And when Mordechai saw that the Beis HaMikdash was not being rebuilt, this is the period when the Persians block the construction, as Ibn Ezra understands it. So he says, you know what? I've been in Israel. I came back to Israel with Zerubbabel when Cyrus said I could go. But nothing's doing. Beis HaMikdash isn't being built. I'm going to go get involved in Shushan, the winter palace of the Persian Empire. That's where I'm going to go. He goes to Elam. Elam is not quite the same thing as saying Persia, but that's its own discussion. V'haya Bishar, by the way, Carla was very kind, and she sent me a whole bunch of maps for those who are curious about the geographic relationship between Babel and Persia and Shushan. So speak to Carla if you want more information about that, or maybe later I'll upload the files to the chat. But what Ibn Ezra says is, that Mordechai actually made Aliyah, he came back to Israel, got frustrated with the obstruction for the building of the temple, decided, I'm going to get involved, and he goes back to Elam, v'haya b'shar ha-melech ba'armon. And he is, at that point, at the palace, v'hi ma'ala gedola. It's a great level that he's on. He's got stature. V'hine, Daniel, and here's the key. Daniel hifkid, Chaverav al Malchus Babel. Daniel appointed his friends to be in charge in Babel. What he's talking about is a pasuk, a sentence back in Daniel, it's in chapter 3, sentence 30 there, but I'm not going to go look at it right now, in which we are told that Daniel, when he was elevated, also elevated Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah to have status under the Babylonians. And what Ibn Ezra is suggesting is that Mordechai gets to be at the palace gate because of the influence of Daniel. That's the idea. So Mordechai is now Bashar HaMelech at the gate. He says, you want to know why Mordechai gets to walk around in front of the area where the women are waiting for Achashverosh? Because he was somebody who had standing already. He was already somebody of stature. That's why he was able to walk around with impunity. That's why Mordechai is in Shushan altogether. Mordechai wants to be where the action is. It's power and it's intervention, as Rebecca had noted before. Indeed.
Maybe it's stupid what I'm going to say, but Yoshev, did he sit on the floor, or there were chairs there for the important people?
So the text doesn't actually say, but the commentators assume that they had chairs. They actually talk about it, not in the context of Mordechai, but they talk about it in the context of Haman. When the pasuk says Vayinas Ehu, he elevated him Me'al Kol Hasarim, above all the other officers. So some of the commentators say that he had a higher seat. So actually there is that idea. We kind of assume they weren't sitting on the ground anyway. But yeah, that's the idea. Yes, Susan.
I'm just a little troubled with him being in this position and Esther, and then we say they're both related to Shaul. How could Haman and all the other people, how could it be such a secret? Like, nobody told Haman, okay, maybe from the king, he lives in the palace.
You're asking the right question. So doesn't Mordechai know anyway who this guy is? So we're not up to them. We're not up to that yet, but keep the question in mind. It's a good one. We're just not there yet. But I want to go a step further with this. It's not only that Mordechai elbows his way in and says, I want to be here because I want to get involved and I want to get the temple going. More than that, Ibn Ezra in source number 3, and Moish, you're going to love this. Ibn Ezra's bothered. Here we have Haman, and everybody's supposed to bow to Haman. Mordechai doesn't want to bow to Haman. He has options, right? He chooses the option of sitting there and not bowing. Why didn't he just leave? Why is he hanging out at the palace gate? Let him just go away. Ibn Ezra says he can't. Take a look at number 3. V'hine yesh lishol, you should ask. Lama hichnis Mordechai atzmo b'sakana gam hichnis kol Yisrael. Why does Mordechai endanger himself and the rest of the Jews? Hayara'oi sheyedaber la'Esther. He should have talked to Esther, but to sirenu mishar ha-melech, she should then get him out of being at the gate. Don't start up with Haman when you see that this is his moment. So Ibn Ezra's answer is, Vachuva, kilo yuchal asur mishar hamelach. The answer is, you don't get to leave the king's gate. Kim yasur b'lo mitzvas hamelach damo b'rosho. Esther's intervention notwithstanding, you don't get to leave the king's palace. There's only one way somebody leaves the king's palace, and that's in a box. The king tells you when you're there, and the king tells you when you leave. So this was not, as Ibn Ezra reads it, just Mordechai saying, I want to be at the king's gate, but Mordechai is actually there by force. So once Daniel puts him there, he's stuck there. That's the way to read it. the Malbim here is in source number four, also takes this position that Mordechai is there as a position of power. He borrows the idea that it's also a place of judgment, and he says, number four, Mordechai nis'ala liyos yoshev b'shar ha'melech al kis'os l'mishpat ka'achad ha'sarim. Mordechai is elevated to sit at the king's gate in the area where the judges sit, like a noble. Sheza asulo bavur shematzu osav b'beiso. But he adds a twist. He says, you know why? It was because he had taken care of Esther. They took Esther from Mordechai's house. So therefore, the queen came from your house. That's how you end up at the king's gate. That's the way Malbim reads it, different entirely from Ibn Ezra. Malbim is trying to answer a separate problem, which I should unpack a little bit. I didn't want to go into it, but I realized that I have to mention it. Malbim is bothered because in chapter 2, we are told not once, but twice, that Mordechai told Esther not to present her lineage. Right? He said it there in the beginning, when she was in the contest. And then he said it to her again when she's already queen. It's mentioned at the end. Mordechai is sitting at the palace and Esther isn't saying anything. Why is it there twice? Says Malbim, because Mordechai benefited a lot from being her cousin. Once they knew that Mordechai was Esther's cousin, Esther is the queen, they gave him a seat at the Shar HaMelech. So Esther thought, well, then I should just tell them he's Jewish. What's the big deal? And Malbim says, Mordechai says, don't do it. Hold off. Whether, again, for positive reasons or negative reasons. But that's the idea. So sorry, Toby, I saw what you wrote, but I'm not clear on how. But you're muted. You're muted, so I can't hear you. Oh, well. There it goes. Yes and no, because there are those who read that the decree to bow to Haman was specifically, if you look at the text carefully in chapter 3, only at the Shar HaMelech. It wasn't that you had to bow to him if you saw him at the stadium or you saw him at some, you know, on some street. It was only at the Shar HaMelech, according to the way some read it.
Everybody knew their cousins. Then how can you be a Jew and a non-Jew cousin?
Right. So there is a possibility. There is a possibility for how it could be done. We sort of touched on this. We asked the question of how could they could not know if they took her from Mordechai's house. There are different ways that it could work, but admittedly, this is hard. This is not straightforward. Rebecca, you were going to say? Sorry, Rebecca?
I was going to say exactly what Susan just said, because it's very clear when Haman, you know, is upset, he says, Kesher, he knows he's a Jew. So how do they not make the connection? That's all.
Right. And the answer seems to be that taking him from there, the fact that let me say it this way. I didn't want to go reopen the whole thing because we never really explored it properly. But remember that you have the Gemara that says that Mordechai marries her, right? That lakach lo levat. So there are a few reasons why the Gemara says that. It's not just solving one problem. It's solving multiple problems. Among the problems it's solving is a problem in the text where we're told already that he took care of her. And then at the end of the sentence, it says again that he took her as a daughter. And that's odd. You already say he's taking care of her. So that's one problem. A second problem that the Gemara is dealing with is they're the same generation. They're first cousins. So why is he raising her? Why is he in a position to raise her? Now, the truth of the matter is that there can be first cousins who are, you know, far apart in years. It's not unthinkable. But that, I think, combines with Mordechai being married to her. And remember, we noted already the possibility in the text that they're not just taking unmarried women for Achashverosh, they're taking married women as well. And so the Gemara is solving all three problems at once by suggesting she was his wife, and maybe they thought he had married somebody who was not Jewish. That would be a possibility. Okay. But I wanted to get back to answering our problem here of if Mordecai has power, what does that do to this whole idea that the Jews are a weak, exiled, suffering population in this book? So the truth of the matter is that others suggest that being at the palace gate is not necessarily a position of authority at all. There's a Medrash in Koheles Rabbah that seems to suggest that. It talks about the fact that Mordecai is at the palace gate, then he gets honored for saving the king's life, and then the text says he goes back to the palace gate. And so the Medrash says, you see that? Even after you become elevated, don't change. Go back to where you were. But aside from that Medrash, take a look at the Talmud Yerushalmi in source number 5. This Talmud Yerushalmi is talking about something entirely apart from Esther, entirely apart from Purim. It's a passage that appears in Brachos. It shows up in Yonah as well. It's talking about the stages of sunrise because there are a range of times that we use when we look at when you're allowed to say Shema, when you're allowed to actually say Shemona Esrei, at what point you put on Talis, whatever, all these different times. So the Medrash says the stages of sunrise are like the stages of the redemption of the Jews. So you take a look at source number 5. Rabbi Chiya Rabbah says to Rabbi Shir ben Chalafta be Rebbe, Kach hi ge'ulas en shal Yisrael. This, or thus, is the redemption of Israel. Betchila kim'a kim'a. At first, bit by bit. Those who have sharp eyes will recognize that we usually spell kim'a with an ayin and an aleph at the end as a true Aramaic word. Nonetheless, you find that in Yerushalmi a lot. Whether it's because of dialects of Aramaic is unclear to me. But you find that in Yerushalmi, that kind of a switch. In any case, at first, the light is little by little, and the redemption is little by little. Komashi aleches hirabava aleches, and as it goes along, it increases. Kach betchila uMordechai yoshev b'shar hamelech. So too in the beginning, Mordechai sat at the king's gate. Ve'achar kach, and then vayikach Haman es halavush ve'es hasus. Haman takes the garb, the royal garb, and the horse. Ve'achar kach vayashav Mordechai el shara melech, and then it says Mordechai goes back to the king's gate. Ve'achar kach uMordechai yatzam elipnei melech v'levush malchus, and then it says Mordechai went before the king in royal garb. So the Yedid Nefesh commentary on the Talmud Yerushalmi, which I brought you there at the end of source number 5, says that those first three stages, first he's at the royal gate, that's a step, then Haman takes the royal garb for him. That's an increase in his status. But then it says he goes back to the royal gate, and that is a step back. If you look at what I brought, Vayashim Mordechai al Shara Melech, Chazar al Sako v'ta'anito, he went back to his sackcloth and his fasting because of the decree. V'zeb makbil l'kadrusa d'shachra, it's like the darkness of morning. And he has this idea that first it gets lighter, then it gets darker, and then it continues to get light. I don't want to get into the astronomy of this and how we understand it getting lighter and then darker and then lighter in the morning, because that's really not the point. The point here is that you can read this passage in the Yerushalmi to suggest that being at the king's gate was not necessarily a power position. It depends on how you understand what Mordechai was returning to. The other one who I want to show with this idea is Yoram Chazoni in the Dawn. Take a look at source number 6. He takes this view as well, and then Rebecca, I see your hand is up. So I'm just going to do Chazoni first and then come back to you. He says, the narrative relates that by the time of the festivities surrounding the coronation of the new queen, and probably long before then, Mordechai had been in the habit of sitting in the king's gate. He's not of the view of Malbim that it's only a consequence of Esther being selected. The receiving area of the citadel, in which the supplicants of the empire waited for an audience with the king or tried to obtain one when they had business. Of course, those who make it their business to sit in the king's gate are no more inert than those today who have a seat in parliament. You could argue that they're inert also, but nonetheless, go with it. And the obvious reference is that Mordechai was by this time a known figure deeply involved in the intrigues of the court. So he's arguing that supplicants sit there. It's not a place of power. And it's just Mordechai trying to get involved in what's going on, hoping to move things along. Rebecca. You're muted. I think the raised hand might have been an accident. Okay. Oh, there you are.
Yeah, I don't know. I had a bit of an internet problem for a second. I'm just not quite sure why we have to say powerless or powerful, because our history is full of Jews in the king's court one moment and out the next. And we see that throughout history. You can look at Germany in the 20s and 30s, in and then out before you know it, right?
Yeah.
So I think the two can... I understand that often Chazal reflects where they are. I think that when they write. But I think that, which goes back to number five and what was said, like this rising and setting. And I think that really reflects that.
Right. And it could be. You could be right. Especially if we take Ibn Ezra's view, which I didn't bring explicitly on the sheet, but Ibn Ezra's view that Mordechai is the only one, the only Jew who's there. You had a Jew who was there. That doesn't change the fact that the rest of them are an exile population. You could have in and out at the same time for them. So that certainly could be true. My goal here is to really just show the two sides that you see. And I think that you can support either one. You can support the idea, I see you, Janine. You can support the idea that this is a power position that Mordechai has, possibly helped along by Daniel. You can read it that way. You could also read it as it not being in our position. He's just a guy trying to make his way and trying to get involved, and therefore he's sitting in this place. And yes, it could be that he's in power and that doesn't change the overall challenges and vulnerability that the Jews have. Janine.
I'm just thinking that I understand both ways of thinking, but isn't there an agada that the Mashiach is going to sit at the gates of the city with bandages and begging the beggar? I mean, it doesn't... I'm trying to say the gates of the city doesn't necessarily mean power at all.
Right, and it's a fair point. I mean, there it's a Medrash talking about him being at the gates of Rome. Number one, I have to go back and see if he uses the term Sha'ar HaMelech or Sha'ar Ha'ir or whether it uses something else. But more important is that that's in Medrash as opposed to in Tanakh. And I think that...
based on a thought the fact that he's going to be a beggar is not a fact, but they wouldn't say something that doesn't happen in real life if he's sitting in front of... it might not be...
No, but I'm just saying that Shar might be used differently over time. I think that's my only point. Okay. Last note on this perek, the seed medrash, because this bothered me for years, but I think I now understand, now that we've brought Daniel into our story in multiple ways, I think I have a better understanding of what's going on. If you pull out your Tanakh, for those who are not already looking at it, and you look at Daniel, so right after Esther is where it should appear. And it's specifically the part that I gave you on the sheet in source number 7, chapter 1, sentences 8 to 16.
Yeah.
So if you take a look at the story there, Vayasim Daniel Alibo Asher Lo Yis Ga'al Bepas Bag HaMelech Uviyein Mishtav. The king takes Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah as trophies. They're going to have to stand in his palace. And they have to learn the Babylonian tongue, and they get the Babylonian name we talked about, but they have to learn the Babylonian script. And one of the requirements is that they have to get fattened up with scraps from the king's table. Daniel is not interested. There's a lot of discussion as to why he's not interested. Is it kosher versus non-kosher? Is it he wants to make a point? This may become relevant. We may talk about this further when we do why Mordechai won't bow, because there are those who draw an analogy between the two stories. But he says, nothing doing. I'm not eating this food. The word pat bag, by the way, is pati baga. It's a Persian term for the meat off of the king's table, bread and meat potentially off the king's table. So Mordechai, Daniel says, I'm not having any of that. Vayvakesh misara sarisim asher lo yisgaal. He asks the lead officer, please don't make me do it. The term Yisga'al is a fun word. Those who remember when we learned Daniel together will remember that we talked about it at the time. It seems that Gimel Aleph Lamed means to remove something from where it was, like Lig'ol Ga'al Yisrael and so on. But it's a term that's also used to be removed from having been pure. It's a term, don't confuse it with Migo'al, people do, but that's an ayin, and we do distinguish Aleph and ayin here. But Yisga'al, he doesn't want to be removed, contaminated with a pat bag hamelech. It's a very interesting root. It comes up in the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's very interesting, but not for right now. So he says, please don't make me eat this food. So, Vayitain, sentence 9. Vayitain ho Elokim es Daniel lechesed ulrachamim lefnei sar hasarisim. So God gives him favor in the eyes of this officer of the court. Vayomer Sarah Saisim Daniel, who says to Daniel, Yerei Adoni Amelech, I am afraid of the king. And when you read Daniel, you understand why. Basically, if you don't satisfy Nebuchadnezzar, you're done. There's nothing else happening for you. Those who don't satisfy Nebuchadnezzar tend to get torn into pieces. So he says, I'm afraid of the king. And the king was the one who said, you should be eating and drinking this, as you see in sentence 10. And he says, Lama yiras pnechem zoafim min hayeladim asher kikilchem. He's going to see that you guys don't look as good as all the other youths he has there. V'chiyavtem es roshi lamelech. And I'm going to lose my head. So the favor that God did, right, giving Daniel favor in the eyes of this noble, was not to go along with them, but not to turn them in. He says, I'm not turning you in for this request, but I'm not helping you either. Vayomer Daniel al ha-meltzar, asher mina sara sarisim al Daniel Hananya Mishova Azariah. Instead of going up the ladder, Daniel goes down the ladder. He goes to this fellow who is working under that sar ha-sarisim. He's called ha-meltzar. So, of course, in modern Hebrew, meltzar is a?
Waiter,
correct. But when we learned Daniel, I noted that there are those who suggest that actually his name was ha-meltzar. It's not Hameltzar the waiter. It's Hameltzar was his name. In any case, he goes to this fellow, and he says to him, sentence 12, Nas nas avadecha yamim asara. Test us out for 10 days. V'enulanu min hazeroim v'nochla umayim v'nishte. Let us have some seeds, and we'll eat that. Give us some water. We'll drink that, and see what happens. See how we do over 10 days. At the time that we learned this in Daniel, originally I noted studies that were done that say that it takes 10 days for the effects of malnutrition to show up. By 10 days, you should be able to see that. So that's reflected in his request for 10 days. So he says in sentence 13, see how we look. See how all those other guys who are eating the king's food look. And see whether this works or not. And sure enough, in sentence 14, he does it, and sure enough, at the end, they look wonderful and healthy. There's a lot of very interesting discussion in the commentators as to whether this was a miracle or not. There's one school of thought among the commentators, I think Ibn Ezra, Rav Sajigon, I think Ibn Ezra also, who say this is not miraculous, vegetarian diet is good for you. And that's why they look better. Then there's the other school of thought that says, no, this is a miracle. Everybody else is eating meat and bread. And why should these guys look at all as good as them?
It makes a lot of sense because the Zerah, Azraim, is including in them what the whole Tzemach is growing out from them. So it makes much more sense.
Yes and no. Vegetable proteins aren't the same as animal proteins. But I'm not digressing. As someone with numerous vegetarians in his family. The point here is this. Daniel rejects the food and instead goes vegetarian. Now let's look at Esther. Chapter 2, sentence 9. Perek bet pasuk tet. This is our only indication of what Esther receives. Hegeh, or Hegai, who is in charge of the women, likes Esther. Vatitav hanara be'enav. She finds favor in his eyes. Vatisachesa lefanav. He rushes in order to make sure that she gets all her stuff, including her portions, and the 7 youths who are going to work for her from the king's palace. That's apparently a thing also. By the way, the idea that Vashti has maids who work for specifically on Shabbos, supported here the idea that you have seven maids. Why seven maids? One for each day of the week. Vayishaneh, which, whether that makes sense or not isn't the point. Vayishaneh ve'ezna roseh leto beis hanashim, and then we're told he changed everything she received, including the manot, the portions that she's getting, for the best. So what does that mean when he changes the portions for the best? Well, take a look at source number 8 at what the Gemara says about that. Vayishaneh ve'ezna roseh, etc. Omar Rav shechila ma'achal Yehudi. He gave her Jewish food. Right? Kosher style. He gave her Jewish food. Ushmuel amar shechila kadli dechaziri. Shmuel says he gave her kadli dechaziri. The necks of pigs. There are those who say, I think the Aruch says, that it's not necks of pigs, it's actually lettuce. Chaziri, like chazeret. Maybe. Rabbi Yochanan says, zer onim, and that's what I wanted to focus on. Seeds, and he quotes here the verse from Daniel about how they get seeds. So the Gemara is saying here, they get that which is good, different manot, different portions from everybody else, and that is seeds. So I could understand the first two approaches in this Gemara. If you tell me that it's kosher food, so I understand. Because the text says they got lito. They got good. Okay, so she got good food. I would wonder a little bit, because does that mean she told them she's Jewish? Yeah, Susan's like, what? Like, why is nobody bothered by this? How did she get kosher food otherwise? The answer may be, Rav may believe that in fact she told some people that she was, or she said, you know, that stuff looks good. And it happened to be the kosher stuff. I don't know. Flat out don't know. But that's one view, is she's getting the kosher food, and we call that tov. Alternatively, it's as treif as you can get. It's the necks of pigs, right? The only thing you can do is put a piece of cheese on it. Why give her the necks of pigs? What's the point of giving her that and calling that tov? Maybe better nourishing. Maybe they believed that that was really good nutrition. That this would be good for her. But the problem I have is the third answer. Who would think that seeds means tov? It looks like an attempt to shoehorn Esther into Daniel. So one way to look at it, and this is the way I used to look at it, is simply intertextuality. We have a lot of parallels between the story of Esther and the story of Daniel. They, along with Yosef, form that triumvirate of Jews who find themselves in palaces and help out the leadership and end up helping out their own people in the process. So Leah asked a question in the chat. I'm going to pause to answer this because it's important to understand. She asks, if there are no Jews in Shushan, where is their Jewish food from? There are definitely Jews in Shushan, the city. There's a difference between Shushan, the city, and Shushan HaBira, which is the palace complex. So that's where Mordechai would be the only one. Thank you for asking that question. That's important. So going back now to where we are, you could just say that the reason why we end up saying Esther ate what Daniel ate is there are so many parallels between the stories. Let's add a parallel to explain how her manot were good, how her portions were good. But now I realize that it's more than just that. This is Daniel's meddling. We know, we already said this weeks ago, that that Daniel was still around after the Persian conquest, right? From Daniel chapter 6, we were told that Daniel was still around until year 1 of Cyrus, was what it actually said in Daniel 1:21. Daniel is still there. When does Daniel stop? Take a look at source number 9, Rashi on Daniel 1:21. Daniel 1:21 is actually really important. I'm going to read it aloud for those who are not still open to Daniel. The text says, "Vayhi Daniel ad shnas achas lekoresh hamelech." Daniel is in the palace until the first year of King Cyrus. So what happened to him after that? So Rashi says, that's the Gemara in Megillah that asks about Daniel being hatach and all of that. Take a look at source number 9. L'divrei ha'omer hatach ze Daniel, according to the view in the Gemara, that hatach is Daniel, and that he was cut down, nechtach, from his greatness, he lost his status at that point. In that case, when the text says that Mordechai was in power in the palace until Cyrus, that means Cyrus the First. And by the time you hit the Purim story, Mordechai had lost his status. However, L'divrei ha'omer shekol divrei, you know what? I need to explain this outside of Rashi's text. I realize that I'm just going to confuse people otherwise. So I'm going to explain it outside of the text. The Gemara talks about this fellow Hatach who shows up in the Megillah. He's a runaround guy in the king's court. He takes messages back and forth from Mordechai to Esther. So the Gemara assumes that Hatach is Daniel. But it offers two different explanations to explain why Hatach is Daniel. It's a Megillah Daf Tesvav. One explanation for how you say that Daniel ends up being renamed Hatach is Chatchuhu Migdulato. He was cut down from what he had. Being Hatach was a step down, which means Mordechai was demoted before the events of Megillah, not Mordechai, sorry. Daniel was demoted before the events of Megillat Esther. That's one view. Daniel had power, and he lost power before the Book of Esther started. That's one take. Daf Ted Vav, Carla, 15a. So that's one view. The other view, though, is that Hatach is shekol divrei hamalchut nechtachin al piv, that all of the matters of the empire were cut on his say-so. Meaning, the name Hatach doesn't reflect a demotion. He's actually in power. Why they changed his name is a good question then. But nonetheless, that's the idea. So according to this view, Daniel is still in power when he is Hatach. When Daniel 1:21 says that Daniel is in power until the time of Cyrus, it doesn't mean Cyrus the First from before the Purim story. It's actually a reference to a later king after Achashverosh. Daniel is still in power now, according to that view. So what this idea here, what we're trying to say here, and what I'm hopefully not mangling too much, is either Daniel is around but not powerful, or Daniel is around and powerful, but either way he's around. And that's really interesting, because it suggests that he could have been involved with Mordechai and Esther. That leads to the idea, which we already saw in Ibn Ezra, that he's the one who arranged for Mordechai to be able to sit at Shar HaMelech, at the king's gate. And it also suggests why they say that Esther is eating seeds, because Daniel was the one who made sure that she would get them. You follow? It's not just, hey, this one's there and eats seeds. This one's there and gets good portions. It must be these are seeds too. Daniel is a bridge between these two stories personally. He's around, is the way that the sages look at it.
So actually Daniel was there during four or five kings.
Yes. Well, we know in Sefer Daniel, he's associated with Nebuchadnezzar, he's associated with Belshazzar, and he's associated with Daryavash Hamadi.
Yes.
So absolutely. So that's the idea. So again, I want to make sure that we understand what we're saying here. This medrash that identifies Esther as eating seeds is really telling us that Esther has a connection to Daniel.
Absolutely.
That's what it's trying to say. But I want to add one more note, because this perplexes everybody, and now I think I may understand it. What is the result of Esther eating seeds for us nowadays?
Well,
What's the impact of Esther eating seeds?
The tradition of eating seeds on Purim.
The tradition of eating seeds in what form?
Hamantashen.
Hamantashen, right? Hamantashen were not Haman's hat, they were not Haman's ears, they were muntashen. Mun, poppy seeds, tashen, pockets.
So prunes don't cut it.
Prunes don't cut it, chocolate doesn't cut it. Correct. It was supposed to be poppy seeds. Then, you know, not everyone likes eating poppy seeds. So they become a whole lot of other things. There are classic pastries. You know, every culture has pastries that have filling in them. So, you know, why should we be limited to poppy seeds, for real? So that means that if I were to look in Jewish texts that describe the practice of eating muntashen on Purim, I should see something along the lines of this. We eat seeds on Purim because Esther ate seeds in the palace. Right? That's what it should say. Take a look, please, at source number 10. Rabbi Moshe Isserles, the Rama, chief recorder of Ashkenazi practice. He's writing in the 16th century. He is recording the Kolbo from end of the 13th century, beginning of the 14th century, Rav Aharon HaKohen of Narbonne, in which he says, Yesh Omrim, some say, Sheyesh Lecho Machal Zeronim Bepurim, some say you should eat seeds on Purim, Zecher Lezeronim Sheachal Daniel V'chaverav V'Bavel, to remember the seeds that Daniel and his friends ate in Bavel. What? What does Daniel have to do with Purim? The commentators look at this and say, what are you talking about? The Pri Chadash is a classic commentator to the Code of Jewish Law, looks at this and says, I don't understand what happened to him. Why didn't he say that? The Mishneh Berurah adds a little note saying, by the way, Esther ate seeds. Why? Why did he do it? Because Daniel is a case when we know that it happened. And Daniel is considered to be the influence on Esther. So the Rama is giving credit where credit is due, which is a theme in the Megillah anyway. He's giving credit where credit is due by pointing to Daniel as the reason why we end up eating seeds on Purim. But yeah, the prune hamantashen are definitely better than the poppy seed ones. Sorry. Okay. You're allowed to disagree with me on that, Rebecca. That's okay. I'm going to give you a hard time on other things, not on that. Okay, so that concludes our look at Perek Bet at Chapter 2. As I said when we did Chapter 1, there is way more to talk about, but we'll never get through the Megillah if we don't move along. So we're going to start on Chapter 3, Perek Gimel. I gave you the structure in source number 11. It begins with, oops, haha, that's a typo. I was not actually confused between Aror Haman and Baruch Mordechai. It should say Haman is elevated, not Mordechai is elevated. Got to correct that one. It's not Purim yet. So it begins with the elevation of Haman, continues with Mordechai versus Haman, Mordechai refusing to bow. Haman sells his plan to Achashverosh. There's this nation scattered among all your lands and so forth. And then the decree against the Jews, 13th of Adar is when I'm getting rid of them, goes forth to the kingdom. That's your basic structure. So the themes we've talked about so far are reflected in this chapter to the extent that we see that the hiddenness of God, right? The Jews are now vulnerable, and the Jews being a vulnerable exile population. Sandy, you unmuted. Were you going to say something?
Oh, okay.
So there are loads of questions we could ask about this chapter, right? Like what, when you think about this chapter, what big questions come to mind? Sorry? Nothing? It's a straightforward chapter?
Why did he not bow? That's my first question.
Yeah, why is Mordechai not bowing? That's a good question.
It's important to understand the whole selling of the idea. Why Haman did it, which is less problematic than why Achashverosh agreed.
Yeah, why is Achashverosh not only willing to participate, but at least the way almost everyone reads the text, he's willing to pay for it. Right? Haman is going to build a wall and Achashverosh is going to pay for it. What in the world is that about? What else?
You're not allowed to say those things.
Okay. How about this? Who held the viceroy position before Haman? I don't know. It's not in the text. What qualifies Haman for this position? Why do you make one man so powerful? What in the world is he doing here? So I want to take the time that we have, the next 9 minutes, and think through the elevation of Haman. There doesn't seem to be a predecessor, right? Let's take a look at the book itself. It's smart to do that. Chapter 3, sentences 1 and 2.
What about Joseph?
He's not Haman's predecessor. He isn't around.
No, but he was elevated, too, out of nowhere, to be next to the king.
Right. So that's true. One way you could understand that story is that he actually has a new position, because we have a famine coming, and we need somebody to take charge of that, and that's what he's put in charge of. In other words, he runs the grain. That's all we ever see him do. Is take charge of collection and then distribution and selling the grain to the Egyptians and so on. So maybe his position was actually new, but it's a good point. I don't know.
The text says that he was next to the king. He was garbed and robed and carried I don't know what it was, some kind of object which indicated he was second only to the king.
Right. No, it's true. Again, it still could be a new position, but I can't prove it. It could be that there was somebody before who lost his job because he didn't predict the famine, and therefore the position is given to Joseph. I don't know. It's a good point. So the text says this. Acharei dvarim ha'ela, after these matters, we have to talk about what matters, obviously. Gidal HaMelech Achashverosh as Haman ben Hamadasa HaAgagi, Achashverosh elevates Haman, son of Hamadasa of Agag, right? We usually assume that's Agag as in king of Amalek, Agag, although there are those who disagree. Bayinas Ehu, he raises him up, and that goes back to my answer before Ruchama. He's sitting on a throne. They all have their chairs, and his chair is higher than everybody else's. Vayasem es kiso, there it is. Vayasem es kiso, me'akol asir me'sherito, he gives him the highest seat. V'chol avdei ha'melech asher b'shar ha'melech kore'im u'mishtachavim le'haman. All of the servants of the king who are at the king's gate, they have to bow to Haman. That's the source for the idea that it's only those who are at the gate, Toby, as I had said before. Kichein tzibolo ha'melech, because that was the king's command. U'mordechai lo yichra v'lo yishtachaveh. Mordechai will not bend. He will not bend a knee. He will not bow down. He is having none of it. But I want to go back first to understand Haman's position. This seems to be a brand new position. That's what it looks like offhand, although I can't prove that. So why would you create a brand new position for somebody who is now going to be in charge of everything? What's your goal here?
As in the case of Joseph, it demonstrates the exclusive power of the king.
In what sense?
He has the power to do that. He can take a person from nowhere, little status, and raise him to the highest status.
But why would you want to do that?
It might reflect Achashverosh in the way he's consolidated power, wherever it is, and this is where he wants to go forward. He's reorganizing a cabinet shuffle.
Right. I'm getting a lot of echo here. I think it's from Moishe's. He's in an echoing area.
After these things, a hint? What things?
Right, so part of this has to come back to the question of what is it that led to this. What's the immediately preceding factor? What happened right before this?
The attempt of terrorists.
Right, the assassination attempt. One thing that's really important that people get confused about, chapter breaks are not from us. The breakup of the chapters is a Christian thing that we adopted. But that causes us to forget everything that happened in chapter 2 when we start chapter 3. This is right after, I think, right after the assassination attempt. Tell me something. Is it really right after the assassination attempt? No. Rebecca, how do you know? Because otherwise I wouldn't have asked the question, but...
What? Yeah, I just think, I'm just thinking in terms of the chronology of what we're saying, but I might not be answering this right.
So okay, so I'm not going to finish that point this week. I'm not going to answer that question this week. I want to show you three theories for why Ahasuerus elevates Haman in this way. We're not going to see two of them today, but I will start, and we'll see one of them. And this is the simplest one. There was just an assassination attempt. Ahasuerus wants somebody who's going to be loyal to him with the power to do whatever he has to do to be Ahasuerus's enforcer. That's the first and simplest approach. Yoram Chazoni again, in source number 12, from the Dawn. Like Vashti's insubordination, the treachery of his trusted officers leaves Ahasuerus exposed before the kingdom and in his own eyes. While he presumes to possess the power to rule the known world, it becomes apparent that he can't even tell what's happening in the palace at Susa. And just as Vashti's rebellion leads him to reassert himself by deposing and banishing her, I don't know why he doesn't say executing, so too does the rebellion of the king's servants lead him to take drastic action to grind them all under his heel. He responds to the chaos with the imposition of a figure he believes will be able to restore order and whom he intends to inspire awe in other would-be conspirators. Haman the Agagite, before whom Ahasuerus decrees the entire political leadership of the empire, is expected to pay obeisance. So that's one way to look at it. This is about taming the court. I don't want another Big Ton and Teresh happening. I'm going to elevate a nobody, and he's going to be the one to serve as my enforcer. That's one possibility. I'll give you a second possibility, actually. We won't do the third one yet. The third one we have to come back to. But this goes back to Daniel chapter 6. In Daniel chapter 6, I'll tell it to you outside, but you can take a look later. There's a king by the name of Daryavesh Hamadi, Darius the Mede. Who he is historically is a really, really good question, but not for right now. He takes power at the age of 62. He doesn't want anything to do with it. He says, leave me out of it. He creates 120 positions of officers who have to answer to three people who run the kingdom, and the three people will answer to him on occasion. But he doesn't want anything to do with it. His advisors, as part of a plot against Daniel, say to him, you know what? If you do that, no one's going to listen to you. No one's going to take you seriously. So for 30 days, make a rule. Anyone who wants anything in the kingdom has to go to you. This way you assert your power. Because anybody who wants to ask for anything will have to go to you. It's part of a plot because they know Daniel prays daily at his window. And when they catch him praying, then he'll get in trouble and he gets thrown to the lions. It's Daniel chapter 6. Refresh your memory there. What you're seeing here is the flip side of Darius the Mede. Darius the Mede is going to assert himself by saying, you have to ask me for stuff. Ahasuerus is the opposite. He withdraws after the assassination attempt. That's why no one gets to come into his palace uninvited. Haman becomes the external projection of Ahasuerus's power. So it goes along nicely with Chazoni, but it's a different idea. Chazoni's idea is you appoint someone loyal to you with a lot of power to tame the court. What I'm suggesting here is that in addition, Ahasuerus is withdrawing. He's afraid.
For his own protection?
Yeah, for his own protection. This is a fear. It's a fear. Yeah.
Wow.
He wants to just hide in his palace. He doesn't want anybody to deal with him. He doesn't want to deal with anybody else. He says, you have an issue? You go talk to Haman. There's more to talk about, plus a third theory from the Malbim for next time. Those who can stay on for a minute, I have a special request for those who can stay on. Those who have to go, it's fine.